Bozeman could be facing a water shortage in the next 20 years. Water resource stakeholders are faced with balancing increasing demand with existing water rights, environmental quality, and a complex regulatory environment. The Bozeman Public Library organized a symposium entitled Water in the West, Whose Right Is It? Balancing Montana's Heritage Water Rights and Practices with the Needs of a Growing Population. This panel of experts was introduced and moderated by Todd Wilkinson, a journalist and author residing in Bozeman and founder of Mountain Journal, an online publication.
Here we are in these times, and I want to begin by thanking Janae Johnson and Kit Stevenson from the library for making this possible. If I could call for a round of applause, I would, but thanks for being here. So just a few minutes ago, I went to the tap, poured a glass of water. Makes you thirsty, doesn't it, looking at it. Where does the water at the tap come from, really? You might say Bozeman Creek. You might be really smart and say Highlight Reservoir. But how did it get there? When did it get there? What are the prospects of water being there next year? How did it get here? And who owns the water along the way? A lot of us don't think about this. We do in Greater Yellowstone. We're located at the headwaters of three great river systems. So it seems as if we are water rich. And tonight we're going to be exploring a lot of that, but I want to begin with just a little preamble. So water supports our $5 billion plus ag economy. It supports our multi-billion dollar tourism economy, our ski industry, our fly fishing industry, our real estate industry, our timber industry. It keeps our living spaces green and livable. And of course, it's the foundation of the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, which is second to none in terms of its wildlife diversity in the lower 48 states. So when we refer to water as lifeblood, it resonates on a lot of different levels. But these are indeed extraordinary times. Think of what we've seen in 2020 alone. Epic fires in California that caused loss of life and property damage, as well as sending us coughing with drifting wood smoke. We saw the Bridgers burn. There are late season fires in Colorado. We saw algae blooms on our rivers and lakes. We saw streams feeding our Blue Ribbon rivers completely dewatered. We saw hoot owl fishing closures due to low and warm flows. And just this week, the federal agency known as NOAA showed that most of the West is in severe or serious drought. The lower Colorado River Basin, where water has been overappropriated amid the sprouting of megacities in the desert, may be seeing water wars next year if the snowfall doesn't come. Locally, the population of Bozeman is sailing through the point where the current water storage and delivery system is not sufficient to keep up with current growth. So what will happen? Janae Johnson reminded us when she crafted the narrative for tonight's discussion, and she used the phrase that many of us know, whiskey is for drinking, water is for fighting. And she added, you can't do much with whiskey except drink it, but we need water to survive. Tonight, we have three very experienced and learned people who have devoted a lot of time to thinking about water. My priority as moderator is to get to your questions as fast as we can, because I know the discussion will be provocative. You can send us your questions via Zoom, and we'll try to cover as much ground as we can. What I want to say is that central to our ability as a society to confront any challenges is our ability to be civil and respectful with one another. We can argue or disagree about water and still tip a shot of whiskey together afterward. We're blessed to have the Bozeman Public Library as a catalyst for civil, respectful discussions. And in these COVID times, a lot of community institutions are hard pressed for resources wherever you're tuning in from. I would encourage you that if you find tonight's forum useful, think about making a donation to the public library, and you can do that by going to BozemanLibraryFoundation.org. Again, BozemanLibraryFoundation.org, all one word. So let's meet tonight's panelists. Krista Lee Evans was born and raised on a farm ranch east of Judith Gap. She attended Montana State University, where she obtained degrees in agricultural business, economics, and range science. Since 1999, she's run her government affairs consulting business, Blake Creek Project Management, Inc., where a majority of her business focuses on the protection of existing water rights and the prior appropriation doctrine, energy production in Montana, and agricultural business and grain handling issues. Krista serves as executive director for the Montana Agricultural Business Association and the Montana Grain Elevator Association. She worked for Montana Legislative Services for a decade as a research analyst, specializing in water policy, including water quantity and water quality, eminent domain, and agricultural issues. Krista staffed the Environmental Quality Council and the Water Policy Interim Committee in the interim and the House and Senate Natural Resources Committees in the legislative session, as well as the House Agriculture Committee. Welcome, Krista. Next, we have Dr. P.J. Hill. Dr. Hill grew up on and operated a cattle ranch in eastern Montana. In 1992, after 98 years of family operation, he sold the ranch and bought a smaller ranch in the Madison River Valley, which he operated until 2012. PJ is professor of economics emeritus at Wheaton College, in Wheaton, Illinois, and a senior fellow at the Property and Environmental Research Center in Bozeman, Montana, which we all know as PERC, where he currently resides. He's authored numerous books and articles on the American West. He's also published on the theory of property rights and institutional change, and has edited 6 books on environmental economics. His undergraduate degree is from MSU, and his PhD from the University of Chicago. Welcome, PJ. Lastly, we have Dr. Wyatt Cross. Dr. Cross received a bachelor's degree in biology from the University of Colorado and his PhD in ecology from the University of Georgia. Today, Dr. Cross is an associate professor of ecology at Montana State University and director of the Montana Water Center, a cross-university institute aimed at supporting research and education to secure Montana's water future. His research laboratory, the Cross Lab, is focused on how river ecosystems respond to human activities, such as land use intensification, flow regulation, climate change, and nutrient pollution. Dr. Cross recently led the water chapter of the Montana Climate Assessment and is currently co-leading a working group on the topic of irrigation and water security. Welcome, all three of you. And if we could start, let's start with you, Krista. Please give us kind of an overview of your level of expertise and your interest.
Thank you, Todd. Again, like Todd mentioned, thank you to the Bozeman Public Library for this opportunity. My background is in agriculture and in water policy. As far as our discussion today, I think in order to set the underpinnings of the conversation, it's important to understand the constitutional provisions that were enacted when the 1972 Constitution was passed. Article 9, Section 3 has 2 very important pieces, and I won't go into too much detail or get too wonky on you today, as I have a tendency to do. But in Article 9, Section 3, there's 2 important pieces. And one is that it states that the state of Montana owns all of the water in the state, whether that's underground, surface, or atmospheric. Additionally, it also says that all uses of water as of the date of the Constitution are recognized and confirmed. Another really important piece to consider when we're talking about water rights and water use in the West is the prior appropriation doctrine. And what that means is that means first in time, first in right. So the water user, regardless of the type of use, who puts their water to use first has in time. So like if you have an 1865 water right, for example, on the West Gallatin, you would have the number one priority water right. And so you get your water first. So as water shortages occur, you're more likely to get your water than somebody with a 1900 or a 1950s water right. The prior appropriation doctrine is common in the Western United States as compared to the Eastern United States, where they have a riparian doctrine. And that came about because of how our lands were settled. Our lands were settled with agriculture and mining. And the prior appropriation doctrine is a mechanism in law that protects existing uses while still allowing new uses. So from my perspective, I have a lot of experience in water policy. I worked with the legislature, and I work with the legislature today, representing a number of different groups to protect water rights regardless of the use, whether that's industrial or municipal or hydro or agriculture uses. The prior appropriation doctrine is a very important underpinning as we talk about solutions and opportunities as we face an increased supply or an increased demand with a limited supply of our water availability. Other than that, I'm more than happy to answer any questions as we move forward, and I look forward to tonight's conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Hill, could you jump in and introduce yourself and tell us a bit about your interest in water as a property right?
So as I think about these sorts of issues, the question is, how do we there are resource constraints. They are real. They are growing. How do we go about reconciling them? And I think about two particular mechanisms that are especially important. The first, of course, is prices. We need to price water. That's the way, because prices are how we reconcile conflicting demands, or prices are the way that we discover how we can cooperate. So prices are just absolutely crucial. Part of the reason we use prices is because it encourages individuals to look for ways of substituting, for alternative for the present way that they're doing things. And that applies to both the people that are demanding the good, the users of the good. If price goes up, they may decide that there are alternative ways that they can try to satisfy their particular demands. And as price goes up, that encourages more supply to come on. Now, of course, in the Gallatin Valley, that doesn't mean that we're going to be able to increase the total supply of water. Krista's already talked about that. We are a fully appropriated valley, and so we're not going to get more water here. The thing, though, we always have to ask is, if we're talking about prices, what are the prices for? And, of course, the prices are for property rights. We have two particular types of water we have to think about. The first, of course, is surface water, and the second is groundwater. Wyatt will probably tell us more about some of the implications there. But when we think about surface water, as Krista's pointed out, the rights are pretty clear, and they should be recognized. They should be honored. We have to start with that. The prior appropriation doctrine pretty well specifies what those rights are. Of course, there is the issue of return flow that we have to deal with whenever we are thinking about moving those sorts of rights around, and that's a real sort of an issue. But I look at the surface water rights, and what I simply want to do is figure out a way to present more options to people, to lower the cost of trying to transfer them from one use to another. And notice that isn't forcing people to do particular things. It's simply increasing their particular options. And so as I think about property rights and prices, I think the way to go forward is to make sure that those property rights are well-defined and enforced and then transferable. When we look at groundwater, things are a little murkier there, and we'll probably come to this later, but there is what we call the exempt well provision. That made a lot of sense for a period of time, certainly 30 years ago in the Gallatin Valley, not having to worry about where you were getting your water from. You could simply drill a well, and the exempt well provision says you can pump up to 35 gallons per minute, 10 acre feet per year. From my perspective, that is now leading us to treating groundwater as a common property resource. And I think it's being overused. It's a loophole that we have to think about trying to tighten up, partially because of the relationship between groundwater and surface water, and partially because the underground aquifers can be overused unless there's some mechanism for trying to control those sorts of things. So I give you three particular things to think about: use prices, define and enforce property rights. And then the third one I'm going to turn to Wyatt for, and that is probably to invest more in understanding our water budget, the hydrology, the relationship between surface water and groundwater. We just need to know a lot more there. The university is working hard on those sorts of issues, but that's basically defining and enforcing the rights. So I'll stop there.
Next, we have Dr. Cross, who is literally at the, no pun intended, confluence of all of these issues.
How's it going?
Please, Wyatt, jump in and tell us about your work and what you, and we'll jump into questions.
Okay. Thanks for having me. This is really fun. It's nice to be a part of this discussion. I really appreciate it. So I just want to briefly set the stage in terms of my perspective in this conversation, what I can maybe bring to the table. So first and foremost, I'm a river ecologist. And so I think about how river ecosystems work. And I think about and study the important interactions among things like among organisms, among microbes, invertebrates, fishes, and so on, and how those, that sort of complex web of interactions helps to sustain healthy river ecosystems. And as Todd mentioned earlier, for the past few decades, my students and I have been studying, trying to understand how human activities influence river ecosystems. And so working on things like nutrient pollution, climate warming, dams, and so on. And so if folks are interested, we can certainly talk and discuss, talk about the difficult question, which is how much water does a healthy river ecosystem need? For the past 6 years or so, I've been the director of the Montana Water Center based at MSU. And this has been a very different part of my job, but super exciting because I get to learn a lot and I get to think more broadly about this interdisciplinary nature of water resources. And I get to work on projects that hopefully support decision-making in Montana. And so that's been really super exciting. One of the important projects that Todd also mentioned is the Montana Climate Assessment. Here's a copy right here. If you don't have one of these, you can get this online. So just go to Montana Climate Assessment on Google. And, I want to highlight a few components of the summary of this assessment, because I think some of the climate change issues are pertinent to this discussion today. First of all, warming is happening in Montana. It's been happening for a while. We've warmed about 3 degrees Fahrenheit since 1950. And there's very high certainty in the models that we're going to continue to warm into the future. Why does that matter? That might sound kind of nice to some people. It's going to get warmer here in Bozeman, but it matters a ton because temperature warming influences the water cycle. Okay. And so how does temperature influence the water cycle? One of the ways that it does that is through influencing snowpack. So since the 1930s, we've seen about a 20% reduction in maximum snowpack in our mountains in the winter. This is a problem. And this has actually been accentuated by precipitation landing as rain sometimes instead of snow in the winter and spring. So our snowpack is degrading rapidly in the winter. That snowpack has to go somewhere, right? And the snowpack melts and melts early in the winter and spring. And what we've seen recently is that snow melt is happening about 1 to 2 weeks earlier on average. And again, the climate models predict that that's just going to become earlier and earlier in time. And so that's kind of a big deal because most of our water supply, most of our annual water supply runs off in the spring. And that's a critical part of sort of dealing with water security. Now, because this is happening earlier in the year, what this means is that later in the summer, we're left with less water in our streams and rivers. And you guys have all seen this. Warmer temperatures, really low flows, and very stressed ecosystems. So that's something that we can expect to continue in the future. And finally, it's expected that these things are going to become increasingly variable. So while the average temperature is going to increase over time, we're going to see really, really wet years and really dry years. And that's going to make it even harder for us to manage and plan for those big swings in water supply. And so that's the uplifting picture about climate and water in Montana. But I bring it up because it's a really important part of the discussion. It means that there's additional water scarcity coming down the pike. That's driven by climate. That's totally separate from discussions about population growth and so on. So we need to be aware of that in the Valley. Todd also mentioned that we've been working on another project focused on irrigation. And we're doing so because irrigation is so important in the state, but it's also the largest consumptive user of water in the state. And so what we've been doing is exploring the topic of how changes in irrigation practice might impact water supply in the future. And what's most exciting is trying to understand whether there are opportunities in agriculture to help mitigate some of the water scarcity that we're facing. And the last thing I think I'll say from my perspective is that I'm an optimist. I believe in reason and compromise. I think that, you know, as Montanans, we're all sort of individualist and independent. But moving forward, I think we need to focus on cooperation, shared sacrifice, and building trust among all our different sectors that touch water, because we all, I think, share a vision for the future. And I'll leave it at that. So thanks so much.
Thank you much, Wyatt. I'd like to start with three questions and then we'll open it up. So I'm gonna open with what I would call first, what I'd call a Mountain Journal question, and I'm directing it to Wyatt. From an ecological perspective, particularly within the context of Southwest Montana and the Greater Yellowstone region, what do we take for granted when it comes to water? And what do we need to be paying attention to?
Okay, that's a great question. I think that, you know, until recently, we've been really fortunate here in Bozeman. We've had a relatively small population. We've had awesome rivers, amazing insect hatches, great fisheries, and so on. And I think that the important point is that until recently, from an ecological perspective, those things aren't random. Okay, those things result from a biologically diverse and naturally functioning river ecosystem. And the ability of these ecosystems to provide what we call sometimes ecosystem services. These are basically services provided by ecosystems to humans, more or less, for free. These ecosystems provide things that we don't really pay for. And I think that is the number one thing that we take for granted. As an example, water purification. So our rivers naturally purify the water. Rivers, when they're allowed to move in their floodplain, they naturally provide flood control. Naturally functioning rivers are productive fisheries. And so these things, each of these services is provided by our rivers because it has a unique combination of organisms and a long history of evolution that's led to these very sort of resilient ecosystems. And so we've been ignoring that big time. And it'd be interesting to hear PJ's perspective on the cost of those things or the value of ecosystem services. So we need to be paying attention to changes in these services. And we do some of this. We measure things like nitrogen concentrations in groundwater and rivers and so on. We measure E. coli, and we're seeing that those things are changing, right? So nitrogen concentrations are going up slowly. It's not like we live in Ohio yet, but these things are creeping up, and these are indicators that are telling us that the system is getting beyond its capacity to do what it does naturally, that is to do things like purify water. And so the number of hoot owl days, you mentioned that these warm days that we can't fish because the river's too warm, that's telling us something. That's an indication that the river is reaching this point where it's not functioning as well. And so we need to track these things and pay attention to those indicators and so that we have the opportunity to respond, to make informed decisions about moving forward. And that's where the difficult part begins.
Thank you. Next, I'd like to move on to a question for Krista. Krista, earlier we had spoken about when a person flies into Bozeman, Montana, say in August, they see this green patina that spread across the Gallatin Valley. And if this had been 150 years ago, the landscape would have been browner, or the grass would have been cured. And how our manipulation of water has greened up and created this apron along rivers. And so I want to ask you this question, hoping you'll channel your inner poet. Western Montana is, in the minds of many, perceived as pastoral. Beautiful open valleys holding private lands, backdropped by jagged mountains on public lands. How crucial is water to maintaining the kind of Montana we identify with? Rural people on working lands, making their living with properties that provide habitat to wildlife and open space we love. Please riff a little on how the romantic image verges with reality, and what's on the minds of agrarians in 2020 when it comes to water?
Thanks, Todd. I don't know if I can be as poetic as you are, but I think you said it very well in that the water management that agriculture has undertaken in the Gallatin Valley provides so many benefits, whether it be the muleys and the whitetails that come down and graze on alfalfa fields in the late fall and the winter, whether it be late season return flows or water that's not consumed by plants that goes through the soil profile and eventually returns back to the surface water. Those flows are critical to the river. And with agricultural use, we hear often about how people want to move. I mean, we're seeing an influx of people moving to Montana because of the beauty that we provide. We have healthy environments, we have healthy air, we have clean water, and agriculture provides the local food, it provides open space, it provides the green. Absent the irrigation infrastructure, so like the canals and the ditches that move water from the river and throughout the valley, the Gallatin Valley would be dry. It's considered a high mountain desert. I believe the annual precipitation is under 10 inches per year. And so the beautiful high mountain, lush green valley that we see in August is not obtainable without irrigated ag. Water in the river is most likely not obtainable without irrigated ag managed in the way that it is today. And so agriculture provides the beauty and the livelihood for so many people, the beauty that those of us who aren't moving pipe every day or irrigating every day that we enjoy is somebody's livelihood. And so from an agrarian perspective, do they appreciate and respect and love the open space that their ranches and farms provide? Absolutely. They are very passionate about the commodities that they produce and that they can provide locally for their cities and towns. And irrigated agriculture is, I would argue, the new norm. Not saying that it's, you know, the end all be all, and not saying that we can't look for solutions or identify opportunities to improve water management or change water management. But what agriculture has done in valleys has improved and increased forage availability for all kinds of species, and in a lot of instances has improved river and surface water health.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Well done.
You've been listening to Water in the West, a symposium organized by the Bozeman Public Library, presented on October 20th, 2020. You are listening to KGVM Bozeman, 95.9 FM.
The next question is for PJ. PJ, you can relate to what Krista just said as a person who grew up on a ranch yourself and is, until recently was a rancher. How does getting the public to appreciate water as a property right result in better outcomes, not only for those who have first rights to the water, but with how we approach the coming water challenges. What do you think are the fault lines we'll be confronting? And if you want to, at the end, riff a little bit on what Wyatt talked about in terms of ecosystem services, if you want.
Okay. I do think that we could develop potential misunderstandings, particularly if we think that, say, agriculture is getting too much water and it needs to be transferred to cities. That's why people in agriculture want to defend their water. That's why I like the property rights system and the rule of mutually agreeable exchanges. And so that's why I want to think about ways of transferring the water. And the basic thing is the Gallatin Valley is changing. If I didn't want to live with a lot of change, I would have stayed in Powder River County, where there wasn't much change. And we didn't worry much about water issues because there wasn't much water around. So I do think that if we don't think about property rights and exchange, we become more conflictual. It is the option allowing farmers to substitute, say, less water-using crops if they want to in a market economy, and allowing consumers to think of ways of substituting, say, with not as green a lawn or not as large a lawn or water-saving appliances and devices. So as I think about trying to live in this world of change, first of all, we have to recognize that there are very real resource constraints. And so in living in that way, then we have to figure out ways of trying to resolve those sorts of differences. And that's why I look at the market for water as a way of doing that. Wyatt's point about ecosystem services is a vital one, because that's just been kind of provided on the side, if you will, by the way that our system works. If we get to the point that we change uses and we lose a lot of those ecosystem services, then we have to go back and think about how do we provide for it? Does the public try to purchase up, say, does the county, do particular cities, does the public as a whole pony up some money to pay for those sorts of services? Do we regulate them, regulate the uses in ways that try to continue to provide for them? I'm less excited about doing that than I am trying to think about ways of recognizing ecosystem services as a real need, seeing what happens if we change the uses, and then thinking about, are there ways of rewarding people who are cognizant of and do things to advance those ecosystem services?
And what we're talking about there, to take it out of the abstract realm, for example, and I know the three of you would mention this, is that water passed through a landscape clean and delivered to a facility where it comes to our tap is far cheaper than having to build a water treatment plant that citizens have to pay. Let's go to our questions. We have a great one from Stephen Maley. We're going to start with PJ. And if either of you, Krista or Wyatt, want to weigh in on this, raise your hand. But let's keep the response as brief as possible. And the question from Stephen is, you briefly mentioned the issue of return flow in relation to water rights. Can the panelists elaborate a bit on what that's about?
Certainly, and I should have been clearer about that. The problem is that with surface water rights, the water rights owner has a right to a certain amount of water. When they use that in most traditional sorts of operations, particularly in agriculture, and when it's applied to crops or grazing land, then it isn't all taken up by the plant. Part of it either goes back into surface water, or some of it may be absorbed as groundwater. So as we think about a water right and transferring it, say, from a farmer to an urban use, we probably can't transfer or shouldn't transfer that full right, because even though the farmer may have a right to a certain amount, the consumptive use was smaller than that. It was being used, but a portion of that right was returning to the water basin. So that's what I mean by return flow.
Okay. Let's jump to another question. Again, any of you can jump in, but let's start with Krista. The question is from William Hayes, and he asks, Has anyone been able to quantify how much water is wasted in current irrigation practices, specifically pasture water flooding, or does this water return to the system? But how to gauge this volume of water? Krista, you want to take a crack at that?
Absolutely. Thank you for the question. It's spot on. It flows in very well with PJ's discussion about return flows. The pasture flooding is what we in agriculture call flood irrigation. It was by far the most common practice historically. And in a move towards conservation, there has been a movement towards either wheel lines or pivot irrigation. And in those instances, you, as the grower, as the irrigator, you apply the amount of water that the plant needs when it needs it. And so what are the consequences of that? And when you talk about flood irrigation, and I can't talk about water usually without my hands, I usually have to draw pictures. But with flood irrigation, it served a very critical role in that that water that wasn't consumed by the plants did move into the soil profile. Senator Tash, who was a farmer rancher from the Dillon area, used to speak very highly about the biggest storage mechanism that we have in the state for water is our soil profile. And flood irrigation put surface water into that. And eventually what happens is that water either moves into the aquifer and then eventually shows up in surface water. Some of it very rarely will run overground right into surface water. So you nailed it when you said, or does it return to the surface water? And you're exactly right. And the important part of that discussion is that those return flows aren't immediate. It's not like the water runs through the soil profile and then, you know, runs a sprint to the surface water. It takes time. What that means is that as our stream flows get lower in the fall, that's when that water generally shows back up in the surface water. And so in the name of conservation, and I guess this is as an example of, we have to be careful on what steps we take and recognize that flood irrigation is hugely labor intensive. It takes a lot more water to move it across the field, et cetera. So there's pros and cons with each of these steps that we take. But on that note, it's also important to recognize that in the Gallatin, the canal and ditch system that runs through the valley, those are not leak proof. And that's okay, because essentially what they do is they provide that same type of water return system into the aquifer and over or the surface water. Not every canal system, every ditch system is different. But an example is on the east bench outside of Dillon. They purposefully run water down the east bench canal system outside of irrigation season for the sole purpose of recharging the aquifer and the soil profile for return flows into the river. So great question. Huge opportunities, huge challenges with that. And the ability to quantify that amount of water as it moves through the system is challenging. But I know that the department, DNRC, Department of Natural Resources, as well as the Montana Bureau of Mines and Geology, has done some research on that type of return flow scenario, at least from the canals and ditches leaking. And I'm not so sure on the actual fields, but yeah, it can be done, but it's expensive and takes a lot of calculations.
Great, thank you much. Wyatt, please.
Well, I just wanted to say that that's such an important part of this. If we're gonna find ways to transfer water rights, right? Like you mentioned, PJ, those return flows are really hard to quantify. And if we want to do an exchange or a transfer in water rights, we have to show, right, and I think this is right, Krista, correct me if I'm wrong, that there's no adverse effect on other water users down the line. And so I think that's a real sticking point in terms of agriculturalists being open to water transactions, because that's hard to do and expensive.
Great, thank you for that. Next, it's going to be a question that comes back to you, Wyatt, and this one is posed by Ashley Gilbert, and it may be one that Krista wants to jump in as well. The question is, while the city of Bozeman recognizes the threats climate change poses to water resources, the 2015 Montana State Water Plan does not explicitly recognize human-caused climate change. What does this mean for the future of water management in the state?
That's a great question. And it is, I mean, the words climate change are conspicuously absent from the final version of the state water plan. I think that's largely political, honestly. And I think that's changing rapidly. If you look at the basin reports for the Montana State Water Plan, they do mention climate change, and it's very, I think, explicitly addressed in a number of other places. And so I think that as we have more and more scientific evidence, people are accepting that this is happening and that it's caused by humans. Most recently, the Governor Bullock's climate council that he's put together is working on these issues of climate change. So I think that Montana was relatively slow to acknowledge climate change for lots of reasons. And I think that's changing really fast.
Great, thank you. Krista, do you have anything to add? You know, why can't we talk, why can't we use the word climate change? Why can't we?
And Todd, that was exactly the point I was gonna raise, is that I think at least from, for example, the Water Policy Interim Committee, which is an interim committee of legislators that meets in between the legislative sessions, conducted a study this interim on water availability and when it occurs from a water right perspective, and runoffs coming earlier, and how does that impact water rights and water use. So I think when we're talking about climate change, and asking why it's not being addressed, one is we're in Montana and people, that's just the nature of the beast. I think that the issues associated with climate change and as a result of climate change are being evaluated on a number of different levels, whether it be from a conservation district level locally to the state legislature. And it's important to remember the state water plan is a guide to be followed. And it was a massive rehaul of the state water plan when that was conducted. And DNRC does point to that. The legislature does refer to that. And the interim committees do refer to that. But again, it's a guiding document. It's a living document. And as we see different or new or anything related as a result of our changing climate, there's opportunities to still address those issues. I just think we need to be open and recognize the fact that using the term climate change is just going to turn shut some people off. And so you just talk about it a different way.
Okay, I'm going to call you at some point and ask you what word we can fill in that will be a pseudonym for climate change. Okay, this is a question back for PJ. The question is, Dr. Hill, this comes from William Locke. About 100% of the runoff from the Bridger West Slope seeps into the ground. I infer that it reaches the surface as springs along the Gallatin. I understand that Northwest Energy then owns it for power through Holter-Hauser dams. Is there any legal recourse for them to restrict residential wells?
Boy, I'm not sure I'm the one to answer that. Both Krista and Wyatt probably know about runoff from the west side of the Bridgers than I do. I don't think there is, but I don't know what happens there in terms of that watershed and that aquifer. I would welcome, that's just an area that I don't know what the legal implications are in terms of, say, restricting wells there. I would be open to information from either Wyatt or Krista on that situation.
Krista?
That's an interesting question, and it's not, that concern and that issue is not limited to just the Bridgers. We're going to circle back around to the property right associated with the water right. So Northwestern Energy has a water right for the dams to generate hydropower. So anytime, regardless of the development of the new use, whether it's residential development, whether it's the city needing water for municipal, whether it's an irrigator wanting a well for a new potato field. Anytime a new water use goes in, They have to show that that new water use won't adversely affect an existing water user's water right or property right. So if there are situations on the west side of the Bridgers where a new water use has been objected to by Northwestern Energy or of any other water right owner, that's based on the prior appropriation doctrine and the requirement under statute that you can't hurt an existing water right. That's essentially what adverse effect is you can't adversely impact an existing water right. So if you want a new water right and you can develop it in a way that doesn't hurt an existing water right, and you can demonstrate that through the permitting process, then rock and roll.
Okay, thank you. Okay, here's a question from an anonymous attendee, and I want to set it up a little bit. So since the glaciers retreated, there were no water rights until about 1860 in this state, and these lands where we sit were inhabited by indigenous people, many different nations. And so we are here, and water rights are a recent construct in human history here. So the question is, first of all, this person writes, thanks everyone for this discussion. And the question is, do you all include the tribal nations of Montana into your discussions around water, since their land's water were stolen from them through colonization? I think there are different lenses to look through for water management. As an example, Kerr Dam on Salish Kootenai lands. So we've just had a court case, a resolution of water rights in northern Montana. And I would like, you know, jump in here. Let's start with you, Dr. Cross. And I would like to hear from so that everyone can weigh in on this, of, you know, where do indigenous water rights fit into all of this?
Yeah, I think that's a super, super good question, and one that's really, really important, and tricky. I mean, this is a huge topic in Montana right now. We at the Water Center, at least, I can just speak to the fact that when we bring teams together to think about solutions and in our projects, we include folks from tribes to get their perspective, because they often have a very a different perspective, which is really, really much appreciated. I think that's all I want to say. I think it's a really, really great question, and they need, you know, the tribes need to be included in these discussions equally, completely.
Krista.
Yes, absolutely, a great question. And you are correct that there are different lenses to look through as it relates to water rights. So when I was discussing the constitutional provisions that create state-based, privately owned water rights, so water rights like you and I would own, that's one side of this conversation. For federal lands and for the tribes, they have a different kind of water right, and they're called reserved water rights. And those water rights are not a use it or lose it. So for us as state-based water right users, if we don't put that water to beneficial use, we can lose it. And that's to avoid speculation and to make sure there's water available for new uses. From a tribal perspective, and it depends on which treaty the reservation was established under, they have tribal reserved water rights. And the way Montana led the West in quantifying those water rights, and they did that through compacts. And so the CSKT compact, of course, right now is very, very public. And that's actually the last one in the state of Montana. We have reached compact agreements with all of the other tribal nations, as well as all of the federal entities, such as the Forest Service, Wild and Scenic Rivers, et cetera. And so the way that the reserved water rights were set up is it was through a Winters decision that was a U.S. Supreme Court decision that actually came from Montana in the early 1900s. And that was that when a reservation was set aside for a tribe, that also included the amount of water necessary for them to do what they've always done, whether they're hunters and gatherers, whether they're agriculture, that type of thing. And so through the compacting process and working with the federal government, the tribes, and the state, We've reached agreements with all of the different tribes, we being the state, on their federal reserve rights and what those look like, and quantified the amount of water that they are that they're allowed, that they have.
Okay, thank you. PJ.
Yes, there clearly have been rights violations in the past. There's just no way of, you know, getting around that in terms of Euro-American settlement, all sorts of violations of the rights of indigenous people. When you start from here, from this point, how do you go about ameliorating those or addressing those? Krista's given us a good background in terms of how the compact agreements have done that. I would say that those sorts of rights violations, in some sense, have been a benefit to the public generally, and so should be dealt with by the public generally. I don't look at an existing water rights holder of surface rights, for instance, and say that individual is the one that should be held responsible, that they have to be the one to compensate. Krista's given us a good perspective on how we've tried to negotiate those through compact resolution and through the Winner's Doctrine. And I think that's the way to go at it. We have to deal with it on a reservation by reservation basis, trying to go back and figure out what those rights were. And there may need to be compensation, or may need to be transfers in the process. I would not apply that problem, though, to particular rights holders. I would hold, say, the people of Montana generally responsible for dealing with that problem.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to combine two questions. This goes back to PJ first, and then Krista or Wyatt, if you want to weigh in, please raise your hand. So the first question that's combined with the second question is this: how would water be priced? And who would price it? That's the first question. And then relating to that is, Dr. Hill talks up pricing and transfers. Subdivisions can pay more for water than agriculture. How can agricultural use be protected from markets? How can aquifers be protected from overuse?
Two questions there. How can agriculture be protected, and how can aquifers be protected? Those are separate sorts of questions. And the aquifer question, of course, is trying to define, enforce, measure those sorts of rights. And that's what Wyatt Center is doing. And I think you're doing a great job of it. We just need to do more of that. The question of how should we protect agriculture? I don't think we need to protect agriculture. We need to give agriculture options. I don't think we should force anybody in agriculture to sell their rights or to lease their rights, but increasing their options, I don't see as a bad sort of a thing. You know, it's telling farmers that we lower the transfer costs, taking account of the ecological impacts and the return flows, but we lower the transfer costs of trying to move water out of agriculture. We don't force that transfer from anybody. We allow the farmer to be a person of moral agency, decide if they want to transfer the water, fine. It may well be that prices will go up, and it will convince urban users that they have to make some sorts of concessions or statements. So we try to set prices. I know the prices are oftentimes set by municipalities, but they need to try to set them at a price such that it conveys useful information. And if water becomes scarcer, then that would be one of the pieces of information that prices need to convey.
Okay. Wyatt?
Just to add, I mean, I think that this question about marketing water and pricing is so important. And it works in some places. There's all across the country and beyond, there's been great examples of this. But we have to be really careful. I think we'd be really careful with the pricing because, you know, I feel like if we let the market just kind of take over and like allow those prices to set up, then those that have more money will be able to, you know, determine the future of the Gallatin Valley, for example. And so I think that won't happen, but I think that's an important thing to consider. And so before we get to this, I think we need to work towards like a shared vision for the Valley. Right? How important is agriculture generally to people in Gallatin Valley? How important is water as a basic right, as a relatively cheap and available right? How important are the river ecosystems and their natural functioning? And I think if we can get that, I know that's like almost nearly impossible to get to that point. If we can get to that point of a shared vision, then we can sort of decide limits on which portion of this is marketable, because pieces of it, maybe we don't want to be marketable. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Krista.
And I love bat and cleanup, as everybody who has ever hears me testify knows. So I agree with PJ that a water right's a property right. And if an agricultural producer or any other water user wants to be able to sell that, then that's something that they should be allowed to do. And infringement on that property right would be like saying, hey, you can't sell your house because you live on the west side of Bozeman. And so we have to recognize that it's a property right. But on the other hand, from the question about how the fact that agriculture can't compete with maybe development or higher income industries for, say, new water, say agriculture wants to, you know, get into the market and somebody wants to put in three more fields of irrigated seed potatoes. How do they compete in that market for that water? And I think one of the things we talked about earlier is worth an increased or expanded discussion. And that is the value that the general public places on the open space, wildlife habitat, and other benefits, and the ecology of the river that agriculture provides. And in that instance, and I'm not saying this is the answer above all be all, but it's something worth exploring. At what point does the public who has these other benefits, at what point do they cooperate and work together with the agriculture producer to one, so that they can't afford that water, so that they can continue to provide those environmental benefits that agriculture provides today in the valley?
Okay, thank you.
You've been listening to Water in the West, a symposium organized by the Bozeman Public Library, presented on October 20th, 2020. You are listening to KGVM Bozeman, 95.9 FM.
We're going to move on to a question from Gerald Grogel, and he asks, in addition to climate change, how important is population growth as it relates to our growing water problems? And maybe Wyatt, you could jump in here. And related to this is, and I'd like to ask Krista, is Bozeman's growth accelerating, besides the obvious, but is it accelerating people on the land, agriculturalists leaving, choosing to leave? So are we accelerating that shift from water rights that have been used for ag purposes to more urban uses? So, you know, Wyatt, riff a little bit on what's happening as we're experiencing this population growth. What impact is that having on water?
Yeah, I mean, so globally, that's huge, right? But we're talking about the Gallatin Valley locally, and the population growth in the valley and the sort of eating up of agricultural land by development is fundamentally changing the way water moves, the hydrology of the valley, right? I think in terms of water use, it's probably causing a decline in water use, right? Land area per land area, agricultural versus development, for example, I think it's probably safe to say that there's less water used by development than agriculture. And that's not a good or bad thing. It's just, that's just what the data say. And so I think it's really tricky.
PJ?
Well, I think that certainly population growth is having an impact, and I do see water as probably the most significant limiting factor on population growth in the Gallatin Valley. You know, there's no way of getting around it, that that's going to be the thing that's going to keep pushing us. There are still lots of opportunities for substitutes among farmers. Farmers can not get that third cutting of hay. They can quit growing corn. They can do all sorts of things, but that should be up to the farmer rather than have it be taken by edict. There's also lots of room for substitutes at the housing level. Most of the planning documents that I've seen look at per capita use of 150 gallons per day per person. Well, that's huge. You know, the World Health Organization says we need 10 gallons per day for healthy living. Now, that's not watering your lawn, but it says a person needs for washing, drinking, bathing, cooking, you need about 10 gallons a day. So we've done a lot of projections looking at, you know, kind of the present rate of water use. One of the things we may need to communicate to people is you have to figure out ways to substitute other things for water use. And that's one of my reasons for liking prices, is that because they convey that sort of information. Wyatt did mention the question of what about, say, poor people, people that may not have access to water. The city of Bozeman uses block pricing. I think that makes sense in lots of different water situations. You price the first volume of water that a household takes at a relatively low price so that you're not inflicting hardship on people that are income constrained. But then once you get beyond that, and Bozeman has about, excuse me, about four gradations, as you get more and more water per household, then the price goes up. So I see block pricing as a way of protecting people from, say, very high water prices for basic needs.
Great, thank you. Please, Krista.
I'll be brief because we don't need to all hammer on this issue, but just come at this from a little bit different perspective. And I'm going to use the sports park in Bozeman as an example. In that particular example, the water that is used to irrigate the sports park, at least a portion of it, was the historical egg water that was used. And so there's a way to transfer egg water use to other irrigation, whether you're irrigating Kentucky bluegrass or a golf course or a sports park. The other piece of this is that to remember is that, and we keep talking about egg water rights, and I'm fine with that, but the city of Bozeman has some really senior and really good water rights as well. And they've been very proactive and responsible in recognizing their need to acquire water rights so that they can continue to meet the demands of the city. The other thing, and I think we can take some examples from the Southwest, and that is in development situations, is to look at the opportunities and options, and it's more costly. And so we need to think about that when we're thinking about cost-effective homes, but to do double piping. So you have a pipe that's for in-home use, the 10 gallons a day that PJ is talking about, the stuff that we really need to be able to survive, and then have secondary piping for any outside use. And that way, when there are water shortages, you can work together as a community to decrease the amount of water consumed out of a system without causing detriment to the actual human consumption and what we actually need as humans, not what we need, not what we want.
Okay, excellent. Next, we have a question from Alex, and this is one that I share as well. So we hear the talk that Bozeman could, quote, run out of water, or that we're exceeding our ability with our current delivery system and source. So how do you address this issue? Are we ever going to run out of water? What are the implications if we're growing too fast and we're not able to keep up with how the water is getting to us? What happens? Does that mean there's going to be a dam up every secondary stream? I mean, where does the water come from that's going to meet Bozeman's needs?
I think there's obviously a limit, right? We've got this issue that in, you know, 10 or 15 years we're gonna our demand is gonna meet our supply, and so the city's looking for ways to find new sources of water. And the first really aggressive place that they're looking is water conservation, urban water conservation, and so incentivizing folks in the valley to use less water, plant, you know, xeric plants and things like that. And also fixing infrastructure. There's a lot of leaky infrastructure out there that's being fixed that, that's going to help us save water. But then the, you know, the next steps after that are thinking about, well, do we increase the height of the Hyalite Dam? Do we build a reservoir in Sourdough Creek? And those are the questions the city is grappling with. I think that, the, again, this has to be a conversation between the city and other major water users in the valley, like agricultural uses, in terms of what are ways that we can conserve water before we start thinking about developing new sources. And because it could get ugly, we could start pulling water from, you know, the Missouri River way downstream and piping it back up to Bozeman. And this isn't unprecedented. Like, look at the Colorado River and these huge water projects. So,
Chris or PJ, do you have anything?
So it's interesting that Dr. Cross raised the Missouri River issue. Not really the first choice for anybody, but there is water available in Canyon Ferry. It's contract water from the Bureau of Reclamation. And in fact, some new water users in the Gallatin Valley have contracted with water with the Bureau of Reclamation for water that will remain in stream to offset adverse effect from new uses. The other interesting topic that folks in the Valley should be aware of, and challenges to water supply are not limited only to the city. I think all users, regardless of municipal, industrial, agricultural, all see a need for increased water if businesses are going to continue to grow and evolve. But one of the issues that has been discussed during this interim at the legislature is the idea of weather modification. And I know that this can be a very emotional and very politically charged issue, but it's worth spending some time thinking about and looking at as far as what they're doing in Idaho, where they essentially make snow through cloud seeding at high elevations, super high elevations, so that when that snow comes out, it comes out later in the season after the primary runoff event. Not saying it's the end all be all, but it's the point I'm making is that there are other Western states that are grappling with these same issues that have identified unique and different approaches to try to solve them. And absent creating additional storage off stream, most likely we need to look at some of these unique and interesting ways that are working in other parts of the country.
Okay. A question relating to conservation. Are we conserving water so that it can be used by developers? That's the first question. And the second question comes from Pat Simmons. Why don't cities require multi-unit living units to have separate meters for each unit and other cost-saving methods like low-flow toilets? Anybody want to jump in on that?
Well, I'll give my usual answer that people will take those sorts of actions if water becomes expensive enough. And so things like low flow toilets may well make sense. They may not make sense to people on their own wells that have, you know, using large amounts of water for watering their lawn. I would rather use the price mechanism than requiring say Xeriscape or requiring particular appliances or subsidizing people to use particular forms of water saving devices. If water is expensive enough, then, and I do think it's going to become more expensive, then that means that when people put in multifamily units, they're going to be concerned about holding people responsible and they'll start putting in water meters on those sorts of places. And so, again, it seems to me that prices send the right sorts of signals about what sorts of actions you should take with regard to water saving. And a lot of that depends on individuals, about how they see it, time and place specific sorts of information.
Okay. This is a question. Do you want to jump in, Wyatt?
Oh, I just wanted to say that I think that the first part of that question was really important, and that is, are we just conserving water to be able to support more people in the valley, right? And it goes back to this idea that we need a plan. We just fundamentally need a plan for where water conservation goes. If we just conserve water and then, hey, there's more water available, then we're going to be right back in the same place we were. So I think it's time to think about the conserved water. If it's truly conserved and truly saved water, let's try to come to some shared consensus about how much of that should go towards conservation, how much of that should go towards new development, how much of that should go towards agriculture, et cetera.
Okay, thank you. This is a question that serves as a great segue, and it's directed to Krista from Chris Caparelli. The prior appropriation aims to protect against speculation through use it or lose it, but informed investors may buy an irrigation water right, temporarily change it to a stream flow, then sell it years later for municipal use. Is this a loophole for speculators?
Very good question. I'm going to circle around to one of the basics, and it's within your question, and that is use or lose it. So you can't get a water right for in-stream flow just by dumping water in a river. It's got to be for a fisheries benefit or for fish and wildlife. And in general, in the applications that I've seen in front of the Department of Natural Resources and Conservation, you can't just dump in, say you buy a 100-acre-foot water right, you can't just dump all of that into the Gallatin River in June when we know that we have high flows and the fish probably don't need it in June and be using it. So the in-stream flow water right also has to use it or lose it. And so it's a legitimate question. It's something to pay attention to from a prior appropriation doctrine perspective. But I think currently the way the in-stream flow, before a water right can be changed to in-stream flow, the analysis that's conducted is adequate, and they're doing a good job of making sure that it really is a beneficial use and it's not being moved in-stream flow for speculation purposes.
Okay. This is a question. Does agriculture pay for their water out of the Gallatin?
I'm guessing that one's for me.
Yeah.
So in Montana, we as a state don't prioritize any type of use. So everybody's created equal. The prior appropriation doctrine, the first in time, first in right, governs everything. So no entity pays, they don't pay the state to be able to use a particular water right or an amount of water, other than the fact that, they pay for the use of it. They pay for any diversion structures, the infrastructure, the moving that water through the valley, which as we've already discussed, has significant public benefits that are received free by the public, and that's fine. So no user in Montana is required to pay a water rate fee. Now, in a situation like a public water system or the city of Bozeman, where the city is providing infrastructure and pipelines and that type of thing, then that's a different scenario because they're not paying for the water right. They're paying the city to be able to use the city's water right and offset the costs associated with that water delivery.
Okay. I want to pose a hypothetical question to the group here. We know that in Colorado this year, the monsoons turned to nonsoons, so the rains didn't come and we're seeing fires. So what happens in Bozeman, Montana, if we don't get a snowpack, we're incredibly dry, and suddenly you have a water scarcity issue, and so you have farmers and ranchers who need it, you have a municipality who needs it, and Wyatt, in your interest, you dry up a stream, you lose that ecosystem that's there. So what happens? How are we going to be dealing with coming shortages apart, in a practical way, apart from just the water right question? Or do you think that that's the way we do it? I mean, does common sense prevail in a water right scenario? I'd like each of you to jump into this.
I think... There, from the city's perspective, they're really trying to get ahead of this. And they, in 2017, they came up with the drought management plan. And this is happening all around the state by various watershed groups and cities and so on, which is a plan. It's basically looking at climate and weather indicators that best predict water supply that year. And they're not perfect, but looking at things like snowpack up in sourdough and things like that. And so the city is working to deal with that. And when there are different stages, I think, if I remember correctly, like stage one is we need to cut down use a little bit. Stage two is cut down more. Stage three is maybe mandatory. It gets sort of more and more. So there's a way to reduce our water use as drought comes along. I don't know, you know, in the agricultural sector, and Krista, you should chime in here. It's they've been doing this for years, right? I mean, they've been sort of watching low water years come and figuring out, okay, how do we make sure the Gallatin doesn't dry up this year? But I think, again, there's not a coordinated plan among these sectors. It's just people kind of doing what they normally do, and the city trying to do much better than it's done in the past, for sure.
Krista?
Yeah, and so Wyatt, you're right. The irrigators in the Gallatin are, the irrigators in the Gallatin, if everybody used all the water that they have a right to use, the Gallatin would dry up five times over. Okay, so severely over appropriated basin. And what the irrigators have done for many, 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 many years, if not decades, is they've worked together to make sure that the river never dries up. And so what I think that points to is community. AGI, which is the Association of Gallatin Agricultural Irrigators, is a progressive group in the valley of irrigators and canal and ditch companies that have come together to work together on all types of issues. And one being as kind of a contact point to start conversations like this on how can ag contribute and how can ag be a part of these discussions. But I think common sense does play a very critical role, Todd. And I think that the underlying term here is community. I don't think anybody in the agriculture sector or any other water user wants to do harm to others. Recognizing that, depending on the severity of the drought, maybe everybody in the valley is without water. Hopefully that never comes. But I think the underlying term here is community and working together. I think AGI is a great group that works extensively with the city and with the county. With the water quality district, the watershed groups, conservation district. So the ag irrigation world is involved in these types of conversations and will continue to be so. And I think the underlying word is community, because legally there are certain requirements, but that doesn't mean that people can't come together and work within those and make sacrifices and work towards a better community.
Okay. So this has turned into a love fest, not a water is for fighting over here. We've got about 10 minutes left. And one question I have for each of you, if you could answer quickly, is we're told that each of us counts, each of us makes a difference. And yet when it's water, I'm going to take a 3-minute shower instead of a 5-minute shower. Collective action adds up. But what would each of you suggest for people who are watching tonight? Give me one thing tangibly that everybody could do here to be a better water steward and ensure that this great place that we love has enough water. So if each of you could weigh in and just riff for a little bit on it. Dr. Cross, let's start with you.
I think for me, in my own experience, it's getting to know people in the community that may be different than yourself that use water. You know, I didn't grow up on a ranch or a farm like PJ and Krista did. And so getting to meet these folks, this is becoming a love fest again, I can tell. But getting to know people in these communities, it really leads to understanding, it leads to trust, you're never going to always agree, and there's going to be different values and so on. But they're just, everyone's just people. And I think that's my biggest take home is like, go meet people that are using water in a different way.
PJ.
Okay. I don't think there's any single response. Again, I would depend upon individuals thinking about their situation. I think the biggest thing is to be aware that water is going to be a constraining resource over the next 10 or 20 years. It may be the most significant thing that limits population growth in the valley, because if people can move other places and get what they want cheaper, then that's basically what the system is going to communicate to them. So I would say that asking people to think seriously about using a resource that is constraining, are there particular ways? I don't know what any one way is going to be, but I think the biggest thing is just an awareness of how important water is and how individuals could make water saving decisions. I would still like to see prices and transfers be a way of trying to meet different sorts of needs to try to promote human cooperation in so doing. And I think a lot of us just operate in the world, and I think Wyatt's point about not knowing other people, we operate in this world where in our particular individual situation, it appears that there's plenty of water to go around. That's just not going to be the way it is over the next 10 or 20 or 30 years.
Krista.
Ooh, I get to back cleanup again. It's my favorite. So I essentially am going to end up repeating what Wyatt and PJ already said. And I've said this for years, water is about who has it and who wants it. I mean, that's the underlying issue, at least politically, right? And we're talking about increased demand with a limited supply. That's the nature of it. And if we cannot all work together, and I think the Gallatin is a good example of this occurring. If we can't all work together, and if we are polarized, the only option is to litigate. And litigation is expensive and nobody wins. And it doesn't work towards a community solving problems and identifying solutions. My other point is that don't assume that you understand how or why water is used a certain way. And I mean, whether that be how an agricultural producer is irrigating, or how or why the city of Bozeman is doing this with their water, or why, an industrial user, why they need that much water. Become educated. Take the time to learn about how that water use is done and why, because that leads to a more informed discussion. And we don't always have to agree, and we won't on water issues. That's just the nature of the beast. But we can agree to disagree, and we can still be respectful and thoughtful in our conversations with each other, because that's where you come to real solutions. When it becomes polarized and vindictive and angry and water's for fighting and whiskey's for drinking, that's when we have a real problem, because that's when the whole world falls apart. So like Wyatt and PJ were saying, I think the market is going to help define this a little bit. I think the Gallatin Valley is the tip of the spear on water issues in Montana, whether that's from development or markets or any of that. And I think the people in the Gallatin are in a very rare position and a great opportunity to set the stage and set an example for other developing communities in Montana and the West.
Excellent. So we're getting near the end here. I want to give a shout out here to the Gallatin Watershed Council, and go to www.gallatinwatershedcouncil.org. They are also an important part of this. I would be grateful too if those of you who are tuned in would follow Mountain Journal, mountainjournal.org. I would also be grateful, and I want to remind everyone to please support the Bozeman Public Library.
You've been listening to Water in the West, a symposium organized by the Bozeman Public Library, presented on October 20th, 2020. You are listening to KGVM Bozeman, 95.9 FM.